Nah, recording.
Yeah, Grumpy Dungeon Masters Christmas Edition, where we're not going to really talk about hardly anything Christmas-related.
Nope. Christmas.
So, I'm Grumpy Dungeon Master Jay. Got that out of the way.
Grumpy Dungeon Master Christopher.
Yep. Always full of hype, bringing straight fire to the podcast.
Yep. I'm great at that. Yep. Doing great. I'm doing fantastically well compared to others and
The main Christmas thing that we want to talk about is what Watsy loves to do around Christmas time, or excuse me, Hasbro loves to do around Christmas time.
Well, this is to be fair, companies love to do around Christmas time.
That is true. Big companies love to do this around Christmas time, and it's lay people off.
The one good thing about I work for the government. So I have a government sector job. The one good thing about it is like, you know how long you have a job for. It's like, you have a job for 5 years. That's how long the contract is. And every year, there's always a restructuring and rebalancing. There's more funding and whatnot. But that happens in fucking September. Okay? Right. So if I do get laid off, which has happened before, it's in the beginning of October. Yeah, not fucking halfway through December. Like, holy shit.
Gives you 3 months to figure something out for Christmas.
Yeah.
Like anybody who worked for Hasbro, they laid off 1,100 people this time, I think.
So, the big news out there is that Hasbro did lay off 1,100 employees. And this was basically due to less than expected sales in the toy department. Okay. There's a lot of numbers out there that you can pull up and look. There is a lot of it comes from the Hasbro 2023 quarter package that they just sent out there. They basically lost another $1 billion this year because toy sales were far below what they expected it to be. Also, none of their movies that they put out this year, which there are three big ones, D&D being one, Transformers being the other, and some other movie. Transformers did the best, but it did the worst of all the Transformer movies.
Yeah, I saw the trailer for it, and I was like, oh, look, another Transformer movie.
But that was the loss on the Hasbro side was balanced out by considerable gains on the Wizards of the Coast side. So, Wizards of the Coast, did 40% better than they projected over the last year. Due in no small part to the fact that they actually reached out and started bringing other brands into the Magic the Gathering playstyle. So, like, they had Warhammer 40,000,
Doctor
Who, Rings, Doctor Who, Fallout is coming next year. It was a really big success.
While it might make them a ton of money, I personally, and I've bitched about it on here, I fucking hate it. I hate it with a passion.
So, overall, The revenue increase of 40% was driven by over 100% increase in digital and licensed gaming revenue behind Baldur's Gate 3, and a lesser extent, the Monopoly game from Monopoly Go.
Right.
Tabletop revenue increased 18% behind Magic the Gathering, The Wilds of Eldraine, Commander Masters, Universes Beyond, Lord of the Rings, blah, blah, blah. Operating profit grew 99%, and the operating profit margin of 48% was plus 14.3 margin points higher versus last year than any other gaming revenue and growth behind Magic the Gathering.
Sounds like Wizards of the Coast should buy Hasbro. I mean, tell me I'm wrong. I know that's ridiculous, but.
So when you look at the percentage change, consumer products, which is Hasbro side, lost 18%. Wizards of the Coast and digital gaming went up 40%, and their entertainment sector went down 42%.
Oof.
Okay. So overall, there was a net loss again this year. So what they decided to do, the best thing that they could, as, you know, high-end, very smart people up in the business world, looking at all the numbers, the smart play that they did is they decided to lay off a majority of the people working at Wizards of the Coast.
Yep.
The area that had the 40% plus growth. So yeah,
that makes sense.
A lot of people were, you know, a lot of people are saying a lot of things. I like the Tolarian Community College breakdown. He has a whole YouTube video where he breaks down all the numbers and the specifics, and then gives his personal opinion about it. But it is very clear that WotC is the only thing holding up Hasbro. And we've kind of been joking about that, but even so, D&D within WotC didn't do very well this year, mostly because of the OGL thing and a bunch of other changes that were happening behind the scenes. Yeah. The fact that it's the end of an edition, yeah, so sales are always low.
End of a cycle will always fall off for tabletop games.
So overall, I think they did pretty good, all things considering. I don't know if it's worth the loss of 1,100 people in the one area that they're growing strong in.
From what I had heard, though, a good portion of those people were also like people who worked on Baldur's Gate.
So yeah, there was a tweet sent out by the head of Larian Studios that said that they tried to do a kind of like meet and greet to celebrate the rewards and everything like that. And when he tried to reach out to all the people that he was involved in the early stage of development at WotC, like his contacts at WotC, a majority of them had been let go. When you look at the people who were let go, a lot of it comes from managers and just kind of like run-of-the-mill folk who do a lot of things. One lady that was let go, which I found very surprising, was, let's see if I can find her name here real quick. She was the lead director for Universes Beyond.
Okay.
For this last year.
What is Universes Beyond?
Universes Beyond is the MTG bringing in Lord of the Rings and Warhammer. The thing that made MTG all that money this year. They laid off the director who spearheaded that project.
Huh.
Like, of all the people that I would lay off, that person is not the person.
No, because that's the person who's sort of been running things to get you a lot of money.
Yeah, so Megan Galbraith Donahue. She was the director of the Magic the Gathering Universe Beyond creative and production team. And she was the one that secured Lord of the Rings. The most successful selling Magic the Gathering set ever. She also set up Doctor Who, Fallout, and Final Fantasy VII, and the Marvel Cinematic Universe crossovers coming out next year. So she's going to make a ton of money for them next year. And what I think honestly happened, because when you do look at a lot of the other people that got laid off, a lot of the people that got laid off were people who already had gears working for projects that had already been kind of completed and were set to production. A lot of artists and art directors for WotC and Magic the Gathering were laid off. A lot of editors and writers were laid off from the Dungeons and Dragons division.
That kind of makes sense, though, with them toning things down for a while.
So, and also too, is because the books are coming out in May, okay, because that was leaked by accident, all right? If you're saying that it's coming out in May, you need at least 3 to 4 months lead up time to just get the books starting to be printed and then shipped out everywhere across the world for distribution.
Yep.
So that means the amount of artwork and writing design pretty much has to be finalized by the end of this month or early next month. Okay, so them getting rid of all that writing staff and art staff from the D&D side of things just makes me think that book is already much farther along than we think it is.
That book's probably done.
It's probably done, yeah. Like, so why the fuck should we do the playtest?
Yeah, like it's not, I doubt it's printed, and they may be making some changes, you know, last minute, but yeah. the vast majority, 90%+ of that book is done.
Yeah. A couple people that got laid off that kind of stood out to me was Chris Lindsay, who created the DMs Guild. I'm not sure what his title or job was at WotC, but that's a big person to let go, where everyone that puts third-party content up someplace puts it up in DMs Guild.
Mm-hmm.
Why would you let your main competition go? You know, I would want to hang on to that person.
There are a few reasons. I mean, I wouldn't even say the guy's competition, you know. Sure, he might could go out and do something similar, but you're not going to build something from scratch that quick or easy. Secondly, he probably had a really high salary. They love to do that. You know, if they feel they can cut somebody who has a really high salary, they will.
Yeah.
So, like, his work it's already done. Like, DM's Guild's already up. It's operational.
But it's still not owned by WotC. They're just partnered with WotC. So, like you said, I think kind of the same point. He's like, it is probably all his stuff is done. They probably already have his input for how they're going to handle third-party stuff in D&D Beyond. Yeah. So why bother keep him around?
Yep.
Which isn't the right way of thinking.
Yeah, and they could have thought of it as, this guy has a lot of experience in that realm. Keep him here because he knows shit. But
knows people.
Yeah, he knows people. He knows how things work. All of that being said, giant ass company. He has a big salary.
Right.
Yeah, we can cut him.
So remember when Nintendo was having their really big financial problems back when the Wii U came out?
Yep.
And the president of the company said, hey, I'm not taking a salary this year. So in order for everyone to be able to keep their jobs.
Yeah.
All right. Chris Cox, the CEO of Hasbro, took home this year a $9.44 million bonus for Christmas. That's not his pay. That's just a bonus.
That's I know.
Deborah Thomas, the CFO of Hasbro, took home $6.06 million as a bonus. And Cynthia Williams, the CEO of WotC, took home $6.5 million in a bonus.
When your stock goes down 40%+, you shouldn't be getting bonuses. Get your salary. That should be it. But I know how contracts work. They had this shit signed when they signed up with the company. Like, they get guaranteed amounts and this and that, and you know, they're going to get paid. No, that's how it works.
I'm saying is we live in such a different world. I would say this now, and God test me later, I would give up a $6 million bonus not laying off 100,000 people, you know?
Yeah, if you have to lay off 1,100 people or just not get your $9 million bonus, man, the dude's salary is probably like $1.4 million or some shit a year. And he's been there for years. So I think not getting that $9 million bonus to go and buy himself another jet, I think he could manage that.
Yeah, I mean, I feel bad for all those people. And I know they're going to bounce back and they'll find jobs and they'll be fine, you know. But I know some tragedy is going to happen from it as well, too. And it's just terrible. And it's horrible that it happens in December. It shouldn't fucking... And the worst part is, too, is that I know that this decision was made back in July when this all came out.
Probably, yeah.
You know? They had to decide to cut these people a while ago.
Yeah, and then
why wait till December?
I don't know. They do it before the end of the year for tax purposes. But, yeah, it's shit. I hate it. It's what... All I can tell everybody is just do not work for giant companies. And I know that's very hard to say. It's very hard to do, but that's your best bet in life. Don't work for giant companies.
Well, anyways, I put up the professor's video, the Tolarian Community College video, in our podcast chat section on our Discord. If you want to watch it, it gave the best money breakdown reasoning as to why things happened. It just wasn't a successful year for toys. Toys aren't successful, have not been successful for a while now. They're very niche. When I talk to my daughter and ask her what she wants for Christmas, toys really aren't on the top of her list.
Kids don't really play with toys anymore. Kids play video games. They are like every kid is handed a phone or a tablet at a very young age, and they're watching TikToks, they're watching YouTube, they're watching other shit, and they're playing video games. That's it. Like
she wants Roblox for Christmas.
Yeah, well, okay, Roblox. Roblox are a toy, right? That's a toy thing, isn't it? Or is it a video game?
It's a video game.
Is it? Yeah. I thought it was toys too. Oh well.
Well, I mean, they have toys as well, but she wants
But she wants the video game side of it. Got it.
Yeah. So.
Yep. Every child I know, every single one of them, they that's what they do. It's they're online. They're not playing with toys. Toys nowadays are a collector's thing. It's for adults like me and you.
Yeah.
Like I was at Ollie's again today doing the last of my absolute last of my Christmas shopping, and I'm seeing all these toys that I want that I don't buy. I will not buy them because I don't need them, but I want them.
Yeah. I watched a couple other videos and a bunch of other places report on the losses of everything. And there's a lot of mixed feelings and conjecture out there. And, you know, we've kind of echoed a lot of that sentiment. You can read the link to Ian World where we released it. The only other big name that was on the list of people that stood out to me in particular was Mike Merrills was let go.
Mm-hmm. I know the name.
Mike Merrills was the guy who designed 5th edition.
Okay.
He was the guy who went through and was given the job of going, okay, 4th edition, no one liked. Everyone hated it. And we want you to design a system that works. And he designed 5th edition. He led the project, essentially.
Yeah. Yep.
To be honest, he designed the best system of D&D out there from a popularity standpoint and from a growing the community standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
He was let go from D&D because of some
controversy,
which we're not going to talk about here, but he was moved over. He was basically let go from the D&D position, moved over to WotC. He's been headlining a lot of stuff. So he was moved from D&D to Magic the Gathering, and he was working over there since like 2014. You didn't hear anything from him from there, but that's a big name to let go.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, you kept him for a reason back in 2014 and let all the stuff blow over, and now you got rid of him? Almost 10 years later?
Well, 5th edition's over with. He's done his work.
Well, he wasn't touching 5th edition since like a year after it came out.
I know, but his job was over with.
there was one other name that was on the list was Amy Dolan, who... You don't know, but she was basically the face of D&D Beyond. She was basically given the reins to run the Twitch and kind of basically put together all the video stuff for D&D Beyond after they fired half their staff to get bought out by WotC.
Mm-hmm.
She did a very good job. It's a shame to see her go. She was the only replacement personality of the group that I really liked. And she was really good at what she did. So they lost a good talent there. And like, that's the last thing that I would be doing right now too, is letting go of faces when I want to start selling a new product, you know,
because they've got 6 months to bring in new people and make new people. So there's nothing that says they can't do that. Get a new talent in there.
I mean, yeah, I mean, she did a good job picking up the reins when everything was let, when everything else fell apart, but I don't know. It's just, they got rid of half their talent managers, so who knows if that's going to happen.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, their plan is to take everything in a new direction. We already know that. And a lot of times when companies are sort of shifting focus, this is what happens. They get rid of a lot of the old guard to bring in new people. like I would expect a lot of that is happening. The I mentioned it the other day, and I doubt this is the case, but I've seen this a lot of times too. Whenever companies are looking to sell the company, they will downsize heavily. Anybody that they think they can dump, they will. And I don't expect that Hasbro is going to sell, but when you are down 40 something percent in your stock in a year, you know, that it's not off the table. There could absolutely be some bigger company out there looking to buy them up.
I mean, that's what people have been talking about for a while.
But this is the first time we've seen them actually, you know, it might not be intentional, but they've taken preparations for a sale.
This is the second time that they've let go a number of employees.
Yeah, they did 800 at the beginning of the year.
Yeah.
But it usually when they do that, it's in phases over the course of a year or two. No. So
phase two went swimmingly well.
Yeah.
If they're gonna sell WotC off, do it. I mean, yeah.
'Cause that's actually in that to talk wrestling real quick. When Vince McMahon ended up selling the WWE, they did the exact same thing. Over the course of about a year, they started letting go of talent. You know, people that they thought they could cut. Some of them were relatively big names too. So,
yeah, I guess.
I'm not saying that's happening, but you know, it is. It's a possibility.
I hope it is. I don't think the current leadership is really doing any kind of good work for. If their whole idea was to make the Hasbro stock go higher and basically keep the stock investors happy, which is a world that I am not involved in at all. I don't like to gamble. I see the stock market pretty much as just a source of rich people gambling. And
yeah. Well, yes and no. You're not wrong.
But when you look at the Hasbro stock, it has done nothing but nosedive.
Yep.
And I just sit there and wonder, like, who are you keeping happy? So the customers hate you. Your investors probably hate you.
For the people who are good at dealing with stocks, now's the time to buy because it's down 40%. And yeah, it could potentially go lower, but with big things on the horizon, it will probably start to grow again.
Maybe. I mean,
as somebody who actually has a fairly substantial amount of investments, that's how I would look at it.
Maybe.
So, anyway, let's move on to a much happier topic. Let's talk about the MCDM RPG.
MCDM RPG. That's a lot of letters that mean nothing to me.
So I don't know exactly what it means. Does it just mean Matt Coville Dungeon Master?
Probably.
That was my guess. So the MCDM RPG is currently on Backer Kit. It is sitting right now at $3,290,000+ with 19,200 backers and 17 days left to go. This thing will absolutely, it will crack 4 million the same way Crooked Moon did. And it's run by Matt Coville, who I know nothing about. You seem to know a bit about him. Everything I have learned about Matt Coville has been over the past day and a half. And a lot of it was watching a 20-minute video of him talking about this role-playing game that he's releasing. So MCDM RPG is just the current working title. It is not the actual name of what it will be when it's released, which surprised me. I mean, if I would go to this point, I would have actually had a proper name already in place for it.
So did you watch his video?
It was a 45-minute video. I watched the first 20 minutes, which is him actually talking about the RPG. The last portion of it was just him talking about the backer kit and shit. So I skipped most of that.
So yeah, he has a video where he talks about it. Basically, unlike other Kickstarters, like even the ones that we've Kickstarted in the past, I can't remember what they are now.
Well, there's Crooked Moon.
Or Boris, Crooked Moon.
Gloomhaven, and the Sky Raiders of Abraxas.
That's it. I keep forgetting it because I don't think it's ever going to exist.
I forget it all the goddamn time. We'll talk about that one another
There's
day.
Also the Orojimbo one, the
oh yeah,
you Miyazaki one that I backed. I forgot that I even backed that one. At least he was honest with this and said, "Hey, this is just an idea you're backing."
Well, no, he the system is in place.
Well, they spent 3 months developing a system, and they want you to back the system so they can continue developing the system and design something from the ground up that's different.
Yeah.
There is no book. There will be a book, but there is no book. Yeah,
there are two books that are supposed to be released under the backer kit.
Right. There will be a book. There will be a book on how to play the game and the heroes of the game. And then another book, which is a rehashing of his current books.
Well, no, the second book is a monster book.
Which is, as he stated in his video, his Flea Mortals just redeveloped for this system.
Sure, but it's going to be it'll be changed for the MCDM system away from the 5e stuff.
Right. So, I honestly don't care about that. I mean, that's... I am all for using what you have as the programmer inside me. It's like, once a piece of code is written, you should never have to rewrite it. You know? And people are clamoring about his Flea Mortals book. I haven't had a chance to look at it myself. But they love it. They think it's the best thing since 5th edition. So, you know, there's a lot of praise, so maybe they're right. I don't know. So, him just basically revamping his monster manual as like, hey, we can just take the system and make these monsters it. I don't care.
Go for it.
How many times are you going to rewrite an owlbear to be an owlbear?
Yeah, I give zero shits if they take a book that was designed for 5e, because they designed the book. If they were taking somebody else's shit and trying to do it, okay, might have problems. But they built that book, they built everything in that book, and they're just going to redesign it with a new gaming system in mind? Go for it.
Yeah. So, when it comes to the actual gaming system, how much of that did you look at?
I haven't looked at anything. I listened to him talk for 20 minutes. Lots of the stuff that he talked about, and I have a shitload of notes in here, a lot of what he talked about, I dig. I really like a very good portion of what he talked about. There was a couple of things I'm like, I don't know about that one. But overall, like, it seemed really fucking neat. The RPG that he's putting together is I don't think they would describe it this way, but I absolutely will. It's a fucking superhero game. Because that's what you're... And let's be fair, 5e D&D is also a superhero game. You know, your guys are all a bunch of badasses. You all have superpowers. You're not your standard everyday dude. And, you know, you're going to be fighting supervillains. You know, they're going to have their mooks that go with them, and then all the badass dudes along with it. So,
yeah, so they picture their system capping out around level 10.
Yeah, which is fine.
But you have to... Let me just look at that. Like, the whole idea of the system is that they want to get rid of the quote-unquote sacred cows of tabletop RPGs that people are very used to.
Well, they should have got rid of levels then.
So part of that is, like, you only go up to level 10. It's milestone based, really. Even though you track XP, you pretty much level up once an adventure,
which he said was, it's your standard adventure, like 32 to 64 pages or something.
Yeah. So you level up once an adventure, and your power scaling is a little bit higher than the rest. They liked 4th edition a lot from a tactical mini wargaming standpoint, is what it feels like.
Which is what 5e is. It is.
So here's where I kind of disagree with that. With 5e, I have battle maps and I have minis all the time. Okay? At any point in time of me DMing a session, I can stop touching the board completely, and I could not miss a beat and keep the game running. Okay? As someone who played 4th edition, you can't do that. Because there are a number of characters who have powers and abilities designed around the changing of the battlefield to suit their character. Like the Avenger is the biggest example. Their basic at-will attacks move other players around,
mm-hmm.
the other enemies around the board, in order to put them in disadvantage for everybody else.
Yeah.
You know? So you can't at any point in time stop using the board with fourth edition and play the game. And the way this system was, and the way we'll probably talk about a little bit, does seem to imply that the board, the game, the battle map, and things that are going on are more integral to this system than other systems. And I don't think Theater of the Mind is going to work with this system very well.
I follow you. I don't fully agree with you. I'm not. I understand. It is absolutely easier to do that way. To do it that way, absolutely. Third edition had a class called the Warlord, which they actually have in the MCDM called the Tactician. It's literally the same idea. And the Warlord could give your guy, he basically gave your guys movement. He could move things around on the battlefield. And yet we played third edition. Most of the time I played it, never had minis, never had a map. Fourth edition, I have very limited knowledge of fourth edition, but the three games I did play, three or four games of fourth edition I played, we never had minis or a map. So it is doable.
That's essentially saying, hey, we're going to go jet skiing, and you go out jet skiing with your friends, you hook up the stuff, you get your swimsuit on, you get your life vest on, you get your can of beer, you hop in the Jeep, he hooks the jet skis up on the back, you drive out to the beach, but you wind up in the middle of the desert, and he pushes the jet ski off the trailer onto the sand. It's like, all right, hop on. And he just sits there and revs the jet ski engine up for like an hour and a half.
I mean, then 5e uses a lot of movement. It has push and pull as well.
No, but
it's minor to what you're talking about, but it's absolutely fucking doable.
The thing with this game, though, and this is also probably the kind of the problem I'm probably going to have with it too, is that they want movement and positioning on the board to be a critical aspect of the game.
Yes, they are specifically designing this one to be more board game like,
and that's perfectly fine, and I'm all for that. And even when you look at their class design, which we'll get to that in a little bit, just going off what they've shown so far for combat, where force movement is a huge thing in the game. So like they want someone to basically kind of do what the Barbarian did in the Dungeons & Dragons movie, where she's basically throwing people around and flipping them around and doing stuff. And that's her whole turn. Being this cool badass, being a Bruce Lee in a fight film, being a Jet Li, being, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger duking it out with the Predator, mm-hmm. you know, and being punched through a log and standing right back up and doing it again. So there are rules that, like, if you force movement of somebody into a fence, how much damage you take from the fence, and then how much damage that fence can take before you get knocked through it, and how much penalty that is to your force movement. A couple of the classes that they showed off and talked about in the Q&A basically is the rogue. One of the rogues like moves people around him so he can basically like grapple them and hold them so you can just stab the shit out of them, you know?
Yeah.
So you can try to play this Theater of the Mind, but you're not going to get the level of enjoyment and fun out of it that you would if you actually had the minis on the board and we're playing with it that way.
Yeah.
And you don't need, like, I could see you almost playing this game in like a 40K type of terrain box and having a lot of fun. Or like, pieces.
If you've got all the pieces and the minis, fucking do it.
Yeah. And basically just putting it out there, and instead of using grid bases, use inches and go from there. But everything that they're doing is, he said the core focus of the system is designed around the grid-based combat. And I'm okay with that. But at the same time, I'm like, that's what I do.
Yeah. And a lot of the times when I don't have the minis or the map or anything like that, I almost always have grid paper. If I don't have grid paper, I can just do it on a basic sheet of paper. But you can make X's, you can make O's on the grid paper to show where people are at.
Again, it's jet skiing in the desert. You're not getting the full fun out of it.
It works.
You're
great.
Coming up with ideas of how to make it work, but it's not jet skiing in the desert.
It's not what they're building it for, but you can do it, and it works just fine.
I will not say it's going to work just fine, because
I've done it for fucking 30 years. It works fine.
You can't say that's going to work fine for a system that they haven't even finished designing yet.
Yeah, but it's a system. All you need to know is where people are located at and what's around them. That's it. That's all you really need.
And they're saying that they're making a system where you need to see everything going on.
Okay, I see that guy's right there. I see there's a tree 10 feet behind him. I throw him to the tree. That's really all you need, man.
Even if you look at the kits and all the equipment and everything there, it's all designed to basically be per encounter abilities, and designed to basically level up a resource to be like a combo point almost system for all of them, which I don't like, but I think they'll kind of work through it a lot. Like if you're a barbarian and every time you fight and kill a monster, that counts as a victory for you. So every victory you get makes you stronger for the next fight that you're going on. The more you fight, the stronger you get, kind of like Incredible Hulk thing. Versus another party member might be more spells based and be out of encounter abilities and daily abilities and might need to take a break. But if you take a break, you lose all your victory. So there'll be a bit of a discussion about whether or not you guys want to keep fighting or hang back. I see a lot of the fourth edition.
Yeah, there was
encounter daily powers kind of working in there.
Yeah,
I don't know how I feel about their whole idea of no one can miss.
The two things that really stood out to me that I was not a fan of was the can't miss. The fact that you can't miss, why? Like, well, you can always miss, man. Like, it's
okay. That's not why I dislike it. Okay. Again, you're thinking of it as D&D. Okay.
I'm thinking of it as a role playing game. So okay. Yes.
You can't. Okay. I'm
thinking of it as a board game. Like, you can miss in board games.
You have to think of this, the way they're trying to design it, is if you look at, let's say, the rogue can attack you, okay? He has +2 damage with weapon attacks. So his damage is 2d6 +2 plus his agility. Let's say he has a 4 in agility, okay? So you roll your 2d6, you get 2 threes, plus your 2, that's 8, plus your 4 for agility, that's 12. And then you get +2 on top of that, for 14 damage. So, well, the 2 is probably already factored in. So it's 12 damage to somebody. That's him attacking you. Now, in the way he's designed the game in 5th edition, your AC is essentially you blocking, parrying, dodging, absorbing the hit, having it glance off your chest, and you roll to hit that. In this system, he wants it more to be, okay, you are attacking me, you're dealing 12 damage to me, I'm going to use my parry triggered ability to deflect the damage that you're dealing to me and have the damage plus an additional 1d8.
Yeah, I understand. Like, it's going to be you just deal damage and then they have to reduce damage. Like,
So that's the part to me that I don't like, because essentially what you're saying is that you have to design all the monsters and all the encounters to basically deal with how do they reduce damage incoming? How do they increase damage outgoing? And how do they keep escalating and moving up the encounter to not have it become a slog fest? And then the tricky part of that is since everyone is just getting stronger and stronger and stronger, okay, and every round is progress forward, and it's just a matter of who's making the most progress, the monsters, the players. How do you keep that fresh and interesting once the players figure out this is the best way to deal damage and not take much? And how do you, as a DM, counter that? Because, again, the biggest problem with 4th edition was not the encounter powers. It was around level 12 or so, when the players got so many powers and abilities that the same 3 to 4 turns at the beginning of every single encounter was always the same abilities in the same way, where you could take your little power cards and just put them in a stack and basically say, okay, just play them from top to bottom and go. And that's the entire fight. And it just got stupid from having to try to play at all, because all the choice was kind of taken out because we knew what the optimal line of attack was. Mm-hmm. There was no decision making at that point in time. There was no fun to be had because you want to wait for that cleric stunning strike to go off first. And once that goes off, then the warrior does his cleave ability. And then the rogue does his sneak attack. And then the mage does his thing. And then on the second turn, now the cleric can heal anybody if he needs to, or continue attacking them, thus giving him disadvantage, allowing everyone else to hit him harder. And it was just the same fucking combat.
And you will, you absolutely will end up with that because of the initiative system they have for this, which I actually like their initiative system. But with that design that you're talking about, it will get used this way, because their initiative system is basically the players decide amongst themselves who's going first. And then a player goes, and then a monster goes. There's no initiative roll. There's no anything of that nature. There's no randomization. It's just the players are going to decide who's going to go, and then a monster is going to get its turn.
Yeah. So the last game of 4th edition I played, I was actually a player in it, and I wasn't the DM. Okay.
Wow, you actually got to play.
Yeah. And we weren't even high level. I think we were like 5th level, 4th or 5th level. And the DM let us pick out our magic items, because in 4th edition you had to have magic items from level 1, or else the math of the game just scaled down badly. And in 4th edition, taunt holding aggro was a mechanic, and looks like it's going to be a mechanic in this game, because the tactician they show off has taunt as an ability. It holds aggro, it can't attack other people, blah, blah, blah. Every encounter started this way. I, as the Warforged / Earth Elemental, walked into the middle of the combat, okay, where the monsters are, positioned myself so that I could get the most amount of monsters in my attack.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had a whirlwind attack once per encounter, whirlwind attack, okay, that reached basically 10 feet out around me, and then I had a reach weapon to add another 5 feet to that. So I had this big fucking 15 in all directions, okay? Every monster I hit, okay, was marked by me, okay, must only attack me, and if I hit them, so everyone that I attacked was marked by me, and if I hit them, they were not prone because my kunai with chains did lightning damage. And they were also pulled one space closer to me. So, essentially, I could lock down an entire army of people, and then people just came in from the side and basically shot and killed everybody else. And I picture this game kind of focusing the same way.
Yeah, it's a superhero game.
Where you are going to have your tactician basically, okay, you go first, move us in a lot faster, because we don't have surprise or anything. And then give us covering fire from this, and it's going to be the same boring thing. It's like Lethal Weapon 7. Like, you've seen Lethal Weapon 1 and 2 and 3, and it was really cool. But now that you're watching 7, you're kind of like, eh, why?
Yeah, we've seen this.
That's my fear for this. Can you take the majority of a role-playing game, turn them into encounter powers and cards, and have it be very successful for an extended period of time? I don't know. Fourth edition tried and failed at high levels.
Yep.
But fifth edition failed at high levels. So I look at this and I see there's a lot of extra design when it comes to the fact that no one can miss. And so you have to basically build reaction abilities into every monster. So your goblin that basically has an AC of 17 and a short sword and a short bow attack and nothing fucking else now becomes this page and a half designed monster because he needs to have all of his dodgy abilities laid out there, and it's just going to overwhelm the fucking DM. So I like it when players miss because it's a little bit of a break for me, you know?
I feel that it, every role-playing game that has combat, I do feel like you should be able to miss. You know, as much as it sucks, and I know they, like, their idea, at least Koval's idea on this, is that sucking misses, they or missing sucks, and they want to take anything that's not fun out of the game. But it's part of the game. Sometimes you just roll like shit. Sometimes you miss. You know, sometimes you do 2 damage. It's just the nature of things.
I think it's more that they're trying to streamline the system and make it faster. And having to roll for initiative, having to roll for attack, and then roll for damage is an extra roll that may or may not be needed.
Yeah. You can get rid of the initiative. Like, you can do an initiative exactly like they're doing it, but you have to have a lot of variation in what's going to happen in that combat.
I don't know. I'm interested in seeing how they design things moving forward. And being that they're the highest rated RPG designer out there right now, I think they'll be fine. You know,
I mean, they're going to break 4 million. I think they'll be all right.
Yeah, they'll figure it out. Am I going to back this? Probably not.
Yeah, I don't have any plans on backing this one. Like, entry fee for backing this out of the gate for the 2 books, the player's book and the monster book, is $150 for the base edition.
And again, you're not really backing, you're not even buying the books. You're just funding them to design the system.
Yeah. Well, you if you pay the $150, you get the books whenever they're done, which is probably 2025 at some point. You know, you'll get the PDFs whenever those are ready. So you'd have access to those before the physical copies of the books. But it's not really my gig. I definitely do like a lot of the things they're doing with this, but there's just a number of them that are too fourth edition to me. The healing, not a fan of it. It's almost exactly like 4E with the healing surges. They call them something else in this, but it works very similarly, and I was not a fan of healing surges.
Well, like I said, if you play this as a tactical warfare board game,
yeah.
Okay. I think this will be a lot of fun. Okay.
Sure. Yeah.
If you're trying to make this a role-playing game, I think you're going to fucking have a bad time.
Yeah. Which, and that could be a problem on their side. Maybe they should have done this and called it a board game.
Maybe. But I mean, just like how RPG is this ambiguous fucking term out there right now. It's a placeholder, and they've even said it's a placeholder. So, by the way, the first God of War was considered an RPG. So,
I don't know. Did it have stats you could level up?
Yes.
I never played it. So, okay, if it had stats you could level up, sure. You know, it's an action.
You're not role playing Kratos. You just are Kratos.
Yeah, it's an action RPG.
The idea of what a role playing game
you didn't play Cloud. You just were Cloud. But it's, you know, Final Fantasy VII was still an RPG. So.
I'm a fan of the encounter system. I don't mind it. It's definitely very different than how D&D is, and I think that's great because there needs to be something else out there that takes a lot of the dice away. Now, when this, they want to make this a VTT. If they could basically,
might work. Yeah, I mean,
take this and make this just a VTT kind of video game. Make it a tactics style video game, all of Final Fantasy Tactics. That probably would be where the real core money is made. Now, because they are a book publishing company, that's not where their mindset went. Okay. They basically said, okay, how can we take Final Fantasy Tactics, the video game, and make it a role playing game? They really honestly should be developing a video game at this point in time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it'd do a lot better, maybe. Because
but video games cost a lot of money to build.
Yeah, but at the same time, if you're getting an initial funding of $4 million,
yeah,
you can design a pretty good video game for $4 million.
Yeah.
And the VTT was a stretch goal, and they've reached it. So even if they spend half that their $4 million and spend $2 million on designing a VTT style video game out of this system, I think it will work.
Yeah, have no doubt they want to compete with Dungeons and Dragons with this. Like sometimes you see systems that come out and, you know, they think they can compete with D&D, but they end up more maybe like Pathfinder. Like Pathfinder has its niche and it's got a shitload of players, but it is nothing to D&D. With MCDM, when I was just watching that 20-minute video of Coville, like right out of the gate, he was taking shots at WotC. He wasn't saying them by name, but he was absolutely taking fire at D&D and Wizards of the Coast. So, like, their intention is to try to compete with them. I don't think that's going to happen. They're gonna do fine. They're gonna have their group of players for this game, and it will definitely pull some people from D&D. But yeah, you know, Dungeons and Dragons is still the big boy on the block. You're not overtaking that.
I don't honestly know how I feel whether or not you can compete with D&D, because I think what they're going for is apples to their oranges or something like that, where they're trying to design a game that is high energy, because Matt Coville seems like a very high energy person.
Yeah, he does. Okay?
And you have a lot of players that are also high energy. Okay. And they want to get in there. They want to play something for a couple hours and be done with it and move on to the next thing. They don't want to slog through inventory management, exploration, and I understand that.
Yeah, inventory management is not particularly fun.
And I get that. I mean, a system that's very close to kind of like when he was talking, I was like, this system already exists. It's the Fantasy Flight system, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Where a lot of what they were kind of talking about and how they wanted things to work, okay, was the Fantasy Flight, you know, the Empire, the Star Wars system, their Force and Destiny system. That's what that game is. You know, I did more role playing through that system than I have in any other game, because I had to role play out exactly what my guy was doing. You know, when the stormtroopers come into the bar and I'm sitting there behind the bar and I know they're coming for me, you know, I can kick over the table, take cover behind it, and give them a couple pot shots. Okay, and I had abilities on my smuggler to fucking help me do that.
Yeah.
And that changed the narrative dice pool to allow me to actually have really good shots when normally, while being behind cover, my shot accuracy would decrease. You know? So, I would just move away from 2D6 altogether. Just design some other kind of system that works. Like, you technically never really missed in the Force and Destiny system. Your attack may have missed, but there was always forward progress, unless you got all disadvantage and there was forward progress for the stormtroopers, you know? Mm-hmm. But that narrative was always written in the die and the die pool that you made for each of your attacks.
I don't mind a 2D6 system. You know, it's simple. It can be clean. I don't know how well theirs is going to operate, and I never did play the Force and Destiny system, so I really don't have a proper context for it.
It was like a D8 system. Well, that's not true. You had D6s, you had D8s, you had D12s, mm-hmm. And essentially, on the die, on the D6s, you would have like successes and failures, and one side would be blank, that's neither success or failure, and then you would have yours and you'd have the enemies, and the enemies would have more failures on the die to make your
right
attack fail. And so, like,
if you're rolling a d8, like one of the sides might be a null.
Yeah, so like to shoot
four of them are the player and three of them are the stormtroopers.
To shoot a blaster was 3d8, okay? And your d8 had a good amount of chance to actually succeed. It was pretty, like, I think it was 75% of the chance at the time.
Yeah, so heavily weighted to success.
Yeah. And you could then use abilities at the D6s or being behind cover. That would add negative D6 to your pool because you're behind cover. But if you're a smuggler, then that swaps to a positive D6 for you because you're taking aim on their fucking cover, you know? Yeah. So that's where the game became complicated. And then reading the die became horrible. And then understanding how many successes, how many failures you had, that slowed the game down a lot. But if you use the app to roll for you, it smoothed everything out.
When it comes to games where you're trying to roll a number of successes, I've always been a fan of the White Wolf system. I don't know if it's still this way, but the old Vampire the Masquerade or any of the old World of Darkness ones, you just rolled D10s, and there could be a number of D10s, and the target number was, you know, you would have a target number, 6 or 7 usually, for a success. And if you rolled that number or higher, it's a success. And you needed a certain number of successes to complete whatever you're trying sometimes. But that's it's clean, it's simple. Sometimes you have to roll a bunch of dice, but it's not hard to pick out what's good and what's bad because you're just looking for that target number.
Yeah, I like Call of Cthulhu too, where I just had the D100 percentage.
Yeah, percentile. You know? Percentile's it has much more variance, I feel, but it's very clean. It's very it's simple. You know what your number is. You know what you're trying to hit.
Like, and then just to kind of bring it back to the MCDM side, it's like, okay, you're streamlining it, so you just need D6s, D4s, and D8s. Mm. Cool. D8s are all the powers, but everyone has their own special power, which I don't want to clarify that. When everyone has their own special pool of power to pull from, for tacticians, fighters, it's focus, for the Furies, the barbarians,
rage. They actually call it rage.
Rage, yeah. And then for the cleric, it's divine sense or whatever it was.
Yep.
But it's all a D8 and it's all the same thing. You're just playing with combo points.
Yes.
That's what happens with World of Warcraft. Everything is combo points in that game, no matter what color you make it.
Yep.
Red or gold or blue or whatever. It's all combo points.
Yeah. World of Warcraft had about 3 different types of resource pools that were actually different, but you had, I don't know, 15 different classes that used those 3. None of it was really that fucking different. It was all playing the same thing.
When WoW was released, there was mana, there was energy, and there was rage.
Yeah.
Rage was only increased when you took damage or when you dealt damage. Combo points and energy, basically.
When you dealt damage, yeah.
Well, energy, you always started at 100. And as you spent it, it would slowly climb back up, and you spent it into combo points, and then you use the combo points for finishers. And then everyone else used mana.
Which everyone knows how mana uses. You know, mana works.
Yeah.
That just counts down mana. On when you're out, you're out.
So eventually, over time, they gave paladins still use mana, but they also now generate holy power.
Mm-hmm.
But it's essentially just combo points. Okay. Yep.
They just called it something else and made it look different.
Hunters now have focus, which is just energy.
Yep.
Rage, now you don't really generate it from being hit. Only if you're a tank does it generate from being hit, and even then it only does it a certain amount. And now you generate a static amount of rage every time you hit somebody. Always.
Yeah.
So essentially you just turned rage into a combo point system.
Yep.
You start at 0, and I hit you 4 times. Now I got 60 rage, but it was just, you know.
Yeah, and I won't fault them for it, because it's hard to come up with a whole bunch of different, you know, systems for resources. That's very difficult. So for them using the same type of things and calling it something else, that's okay. I don't have much problem with that.
I do, because this is not directed towards MCDM. I have a problem with it because they're trying to take credit for something that is the exact same thing.
Yeah.
It's if you're all gonna have focus and fury and rage, and it's all gonna be generated the same way, you know, be a pool that you can use throughout the day, then just come up with a name and make it unified.
Right.
Don't
they
try
should,
to
yeah.
convince me that you designed four different systems all at the same time.
Right. Call it resource, or, you know, give it a name and just have everyone operate under the same system.
Call it Buck Whipple.
Yeah, perfect. Every time I attack, I gain Buck Whipple.
When you wake up in the morning, you start off with four Buck Whipple. When you make an attack, you gain half a Buck Whipple. So when you attack twice, you gain one Buck Whipple. When you do special attack, it costs two Buck Whipple. When I do super ultra daily, it costs you four Buck Whipple.
All right, now you are a spellcaster, so you're going to start with 10 Buck Whipple, but every time you cast a spell, it uses two Buck Whipple. Yeah, it's the same system. Just, you know, call it. They've been giving it different names. Works the same damn way. So, anyway, all right, let's move on to the last topic that you wanted to talk about before we wrap this thing up.
Where did I put the book? Blaze, where did I put my book?
You lost it already, or the cat ate it.
It was standing up right in front of me. What did I do with it?
I don't know. You're the one who had it, not I.
I was probably having a coughing fit and I died. And all right. So this came in the mail today. And we haven't done our year in review yet. That's going to be probably next podcast.
Oh, okay.
All right.
What are we reviewing? This,
well, just the year in review. What was the best thing of 2023?
Oh, Lord. I have to think about everything I did this year?
Yeah.
Ugh.
So I'm going to say that what I'm holding in my hands right now is, of all the RPGs that I touched and picked up and looked at today, and this kind of goes through all the ones that I backed, all the extra books that I bought from Mr. Ed Greenwood, the Book of Fiends that I found, the Ouroboros book. This is my role-playing RPG of 2023.
All right. That's high praise.
And it is the Humblewood campaign setting.
Yep, which you have talked about on here before.
I've only talked about it in the mention because I knew it existed, and I never actually had a chance.
You've talked about it. You've never gone into great detail because we didn't have the book.
But I now have the book. All right. First off, the first thing I want to say is that they hired a number of different artists that are all fantastic. But they hired one artist who specifically drew kind of like these small, chibi variants of all their characters throughout the book. And if you look and follow the pages, the chibi owl, the owl that's on like the front cover, like who's like the mascot of Humblewood, he's like a little tiny owl in like knight armor.
Yep. I'm looking at him right now.
You're looking at him right now. Yeah, him. So there's a little chibi version of him someone did, and basically just pencil drawing. And it's him discovering a slime, and then the slime attacking him, and him being chased around the slime, him chasing the slime, until eventually at the end of the book, a hedgehog rescues him, and then they have a picnic, and now he's friends with the slime. All right.
That's lovely.
So it's lovely. It's great. The pictures are amazing. But I was going through and reading this, and this book by Hit Point Press, is exactly what I think all books that get published for 5th edition should be. Okay. So just going through the table of contents real quick, it has, the first chapter is basically Welcome to the Wood, which just talks about all the races that are in this campaign setting, the characters, the languages. They give you an example of the language and what the alphabet is. Then they have their class options, their new backgrounds, their new feats, their new spells, and the spell descriptions. Then they start talking about the world, the wood is what they call it. And they talk about the Amaranthine, all the areas around it, what makes up the Amaranthine, which is actually the religion in the wood. Then they talk about the locations in the wood, the different cities and areas. Like, there's the Scorch Grove, which is actually the main campaign story that they talk about later, deals with the Scorch Grove, which is a part of the forest that burned down, but nothing regrows in that area. And then the rest of the book is pretty much the campaign setting. And then you have your standard appendixes that are the bestiary, the NPCs, creating NPCs, magic items, random encounters. What did they find? Which is a really cool table we'll talk about in a bit. The index in the last page, of course, is the OGL 1.0A license.
So I could play a raccoon in this.
So getting first is what I love about this is the races that they introduce, they have the bird folk and the humble folk. Okay. So the bird folk are basically doves, ravens, raptors, peacocks, and owls. And
I could play cinnamon.
And then the humble folk are foxes, raccoons, field mice, hedgehogs, and deer. Okay.
Okay.
Lots
of good options.
And also, too, like, normal animals still exist. So, like, mountain tigers and bears still exist and are a normal standard thing. So, when you get to the races and the breakdown, okay, so, like, coming up here first with the raven, they give you your base ability scores, and it says that ravens have +2 to intelligence, no matter what, you can't change it. +2 to intelligence. They give you your age. There are alignments that ravens normally are. They're shrewd and capable. They prefer moral flexibility. They are more likely to be neutral than good or evil. Some see the benefit of rules. Some like to use them to their own advantage. Because of this, they favor lawful alignments. Okay. They talk about their size and their walking speed. Because the raven, they call him the Corvum, is a bird folk, they have glide. None of them can really fly. But they have glide as a racial trait where they can basically reduce falling
damage.
Is this
a 5e game?
Yes.
Okay.
And then they have like talons, appraising eye, languages, and then subraces. And you have to pick a subrace because when you pick a subrace, that's where you get your other +1. So if you go with a dusk raven, your dexterity score goes up by 1 and you become a better sneak. Or if you go with a kindled raven, your charisma goes up by 1, and you become a sharp mind. You can convince people to do things, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And every race is divided up like that, okay? So if I were to get to, like, the hawks, okay, they start off with a +2 to dexterity, and then they have the hawks that go into, like, to the ocean, into lakes and stuff like that to get their prey and eat fish.
Yeah.
They get a swimming speed and plus intelligence.
So like a heron or something.
Yeah. And then, the other one gets a plus the wisdom and they're just really cool acrobatic, hawks.
Okay.
And owls have start with increased strength. And then you have basically the dexterity based, owl and the con based owl, which is kind of funny.
I don't know that any of those properly fit, but I would have gone with a wisdom-based owl.
Well, you can be for them. They have owls being bigger brutes.
Yeah, I don't know that it fits, but all right, moving on.
So when I got to the hedgehog, okay. So basically, you picture this hedgehog as a bard, and that's exactly what they are. All hedgehogs are bards. So they have charisma by 2 and wisdom by 1. And then all these like extra bonuses to like talk to bugs and shit like that. And it was just really, really cute kind of going through the races. And they got a good page and a half for every single race. And I kept going through. And what I really, really liked, aside from the fact that they have a full alphabet in here, was the class options. So they have an extra bard. They have 2 domains for the cleric, basically a daytime and a nighttime domain.
Okay.
And they have a fighter archetype called the Scofflaw. All right. But I want to go over the bard.
That's a good word. I love that word, Scofflaw.
I want to go over the bard because I think this bard competes with the College of Whistles.
Oh, okay.
All right. So this is called, this bard college is called the College of the Road. Alright. It said, not an officially recognized college, the College of the Road represents the personal and electric sets of skills, knowledge, and techniques a wandering bard picks up along their journey. A jack of all trades, the bard possesses a variety of aptitudes in combat, magecraft, and general know-how, making them particularly well-suited to learning a variety of different skills. It often happens that while traveling, a bard winds up sharing their campfire with a motley assortment of wandering adventurers who may impart valuable lessons in exchange for a lively song or a well-told tale. Compared to a student of other bard colleges, a special kind of sensibility is important for the College of the Road. How effectively a bard of this college can apply what they have learned depends on their understanding and insight. The College of the Road is sometimes a harsh teacher, but bards who follow this path often find themselves rewarded with a diverse array of useful tricks and tactics. Those who underestimate the bard from the College of the Road soon find that these gratitudes are full of surprises. So, at third level, you get a bonus in proficiency, Wanderer's Lore, and two Traveler Tricks. Okay? At sixth level, you gain a Favorite Trick, Improved Tricks, and you get an additional Traveler Trick. At 14th level, you have two Favorite Tricks, you get Improved Tricks, and you get an additional Traveler Trick. So the bonus proficiency is just a martial weapon of your choice, herbal skills, thieves tools, a skill of your choice, languages, whatever. The tricks are what's the best part is.
Okay? Do any of them summon a grumpy?
No.
Yeah, that's not as good.
No, listen. Essentially, the Traveler Trick feature lets you choose an option for it at certain levels. The options are presented here in alphabetical order. Each one is associated with a different class, and those marked with an asterisk are magical effects. Unlike traditional bard abilities, which rely on skill or panache to be properly executed, the greatest asset for picking up a trick along the road is common sense and an openness to learning new ideas. Wisdom affects how powerful your traveler's tricks are, as well as how hard they are to counter. If an opponent requires a saving throw, your traveler's trick is your DC 8 plus your proficiency plus your wisdom. So essentially, each trick is related to one of the classes. Okay. So I'm gonna read one of my favorites. Boxing Lessons. Okay.
All right.
A wise monk was happy to share his basic form on the jab and weave. When you take this attack action, you can spend one of your bardic inspirations to quickly execute two unarmed strikes against one or more creatures you could target. You may use dexterity or strength for the attack and damage roll of these unarmed strikes. The damage die used in these unarmed strikes is the same as your bardic inspiration die. At 6th level, you finally mastered the weave portion of your technique. You do not provoke opportunity attacks this turn. At 14th level, your practice has paid off, granting you the use of a slightly key-infused attack. When you hit with one of these attacks, you may attempt a stunning strike. The target must succeed a con saving throw or be stunned until the end of your next turn. Yeah. So
you're a bard monk.
You're a bard monk. And like Reckless Tactics, it gives you basically rage.
Oh.
I love it, because like, I don't like multiclassing a lot in 5th edition.
Yeah.
But I would play this bard and like,
so what you want is it's giving you a very limited ability to actually build a character differently.
Yeah.
Which is something I've literally complained about 5e from day one not doing. It's a cool subclass because it's letting you do something new and different that other subclasses don't. So I'm down with that. It's still not College of Whistles because
I think it's much better.
It can't summon a grumpy, and that's literally the best thing ever. But it's good. I like it. I get the gist of it. So,
there weren't anything crazy that stood out with the defeats or anything like that. Just improvements on like the gliding abilities and better wood survival based feats and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And the spell descriptions were basically, there wasn't anything crazy there either. Just here are some things that are more thematic to this campaign setting.
Mm-hmm.
Like Gust Barrier was the only one that really stood out as something like hopefully unique, because being able to control the wind in this setting is a pretty big deal. So if you are a caster that can basically cast Gust Barrier, people might think that you're some kind of prophet or a divine being because of that. Gust Barrier is a cantrip. It's just somatic. You spread your arms wide, allowing yourself to become enveloped in the air around you until the end of your next turn. Any range attack made against you is done with disadvantage. Melee attackers who successfully hit you must make a con saving throw against your spell save DC. On a failure, the attacker is flung away from you up to 10 feet and is knocked prone.
Huh. That's actually not bad.
That was the best of the bunch, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But like, it was very, everything just fit very thematically. There weren't any crazy items either. The only one of note that stood out was something I had to look up as well. Let me get here to the... That's the bestiary. Bestiary is pretty cool. Again, just thematic cool monsters that fit the setting. Mountain lions.
Yeah.
A lot of scary freaking monsters, but nothing totally crazy. And their NPC list is also just kind of basically an extended monster list too. Like the bestiaries are a bunch of beasts, but if you want to fight like guards in a town, you'd use the NPC list for that. All right. Magic items. Okay, here it is. The Necronomicon X Corvus.
I love it. X Corvus.
Yeah. So, I had to look this up. Necronomicon, that directly translates to Book of the Dead, right?
Yeah.
So, the Necronomicon Ex Mortis?
Book of the Raven. Yeah.
No. From Evil Dead. The Necronomicon Ex Mortis.
Was Book of the Dead.
Okay, but so what's Ex Mortis mean? If Necronomicon means Book of the Dead, what does Ex Mortis mean? The Book of the Dead of the Dead?
Oh, yeah, that's a good... I don't know. Probably.
Because the I think it was a Hindu word where Necronomicon comes from, and that just meant Book of the Dead. So if Necronomicon Ex Mortis was Grimoire of the Dead...
Maybe. I honestly think Book of the Dead of the Dead, is while it's ridiculous, that sounds accurate.
So the Necronomicon Ex Corvus, the Book of the Dead of the Raven.
Of the Raven, yes.
This is actually a pretty cool item. It's the Necronomicon, of course.
Sure.
I'll kind of read through the description of this. By spending a full week studying the dark secrets of this tome, your intelligence score increases by 2. These secrets notch your mind, however, and your wisdom score decreases by 1. Awesome.
Yep.
Grasp of Shadows. By spending at least 1 minute reciting a ritual listed in the book, you can summon forth 1d4 plus 2 shadows. They will carry out your instructions to the best of your ability. It can only happen once per week. Knowledge Beyond Reason, and this is the really cool part. You may add the spells listed below into your spellbook. However, the tome removes the restriction that requires you to be able to prepare and cast these spells.
Oh.
In effect, you can copy these spells into your spellbook now, though they will only be available to prepare once you reach a level at which you can cast them.
Oh.
Additionally, rather than pay gold pieces to copy any spell within your spellbook, you may deal 1 point of damage to yourself and take 1 level of exhaustion to scribe the spell on your own blood. So essentially, you can get Animate Dead, Bestow Curse, Vampiric Touch, Blight, Circle of Death, Magic Jar, and Finger of Death for free.
Yeah. It saves you money and the going out to find those things.
You don't have to prepare them.
Yeah, but you can't do anything with them until you would actually be high enough level to cast
them. Right. The Corvum's Curse. After copying at least 1 spell from this tome into your spellbook, you must succeed a DC 16 wisdom saving throw or become cursed. And it's a curse from the DMG. Destroying the book. Unlike other artifacts, this book is not immune to damage. Pages removed from the book will lose their magic within a day. Additionally, exposing the book to direct sunlight for at least 8 hours will cause the dark magic within to dissipate, rendering it useless.
Yep, gotta have a way to destroy it.
If a lot of people take famous magic items from history and
sure. yeah.
throw them in. Necronomicon's a big one. Vorpal Blade's another. I use the Vorpal Blade.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the times, let's say I put a Vorpal Blade in the video game. What would you expect the Vorpal Blade to do?
Behead something.
On a critical hit, it beheads something and it dies. Or, because the blade goes snicker snack, it attacks twice every time you attack once. So there's a lot of like guesswork and changings of how things can be. But when I look at that Necronomicon Ex Corvus, I think that's the best interpretation of the Necronomicon I've seen in any media out there.
My only thing that those shadows that it can summon, they need to be birds.
I mean, of course.
Yeah.
They can be Raven birds, Raven shadows.
Like, they have to be ravens. That's it. No other way around it.
So like I said, I kind of thumbed through this whole book. I looked at the map. I looked through the adventure a little bit. The adventure is really cool because, like, it gives you a map for every single encounter. There's tons of extra tables all throughout the thing. The table in the appendix at the very end, it was kind of cool. It was pretty much, if you rifle through somebody's pockets or, like, their treasure chest, mm-hmm. what do you find? Okay?
Yeah.
So it's a D20 table. Let's say I basically beat the crap out of you, and I ruffle through your pockets, Jay, and I roll a D20, and I get a 16.
You find chapstick.
I find a bandit mask from a time before the Coalition.
He's a traitor.
I think that's really cool. I like the little table.
I love tables like that. You know I do.
And like I said, I got the campaign box, all right?
Mm-hmm.
Which I think was like $40 because I got the imperfect one, which is meaningless, all things considered. So this campaign setting box comes with a bunch of maps, okay? Like a ton of maps, the campaign book, reference cards, and then a bunch of punch-out monster tokens and stands that you can use that cover all the monsters and NPCs you would need. So, like, I want to write my Owl campaign and get it published, you know? Like, this is, like, the gold standard that I'd have to meet in order for me to have my campaign be a success. Like, this is the minimum it has to be.
Okay.
So, I have a lot of work ahead of me.
So, it comes with things that you can use in as minis, basically.
Yeah. It's great. It was, like, $30. Like,
yeah, for the price... Because I looked on their website, and yeah, they were selling the imperfect editions of the box set for $40.
They still are.
Yeah, which is ridiculously freaking cheap.
Campaign book's like $10. The campaign box set, which is the book and everything else, is like, what, I think 40, I think?
Yeah. The box set was $40, which comes with all the stuff you've talked about.
It's so worth it. It really is. Like, honestly, like, it's the best product that I have touched this year.
Yeah, for me, I know there's a zero chance I ever run anything with it or do anything with it, so I'm not going to mess with it. But for somebody who would run that setting, it's $40, man.
Yeah.
Like, you really can't go wrong. Like, that is a hell of a steal, is what that is. So, get it while they've still got some left, people.
So, last thing before we go, are you going to have a white Christmas?
I don't know if it's going to snow here. I'm in Alabama. Probably not.
No, it's not. I saw a chart on the news today, which covered all of our state, and a grid that said, basically, will there be a white Christmas for you? And then there's a section in pink and a section in blue.
Yeah.
And when you look at the legend of it, it says no for pink.
Yep.
And then for blue, it's no, but in blue.
Yeah. You're near the coast, so no, there's no chance of you getting a white Christmas. Best of luck to ye.
Yeah, if we're getting ocean effect snow, like the
where you're
who
at.
Around,
ooh.
Yeah, so if we're getting ocean effect snow, like people up near the Great Lakes get lake effect snow, mm-hmm. that means it would have to be consistently below 0 degrees Fahrenheit for the wind to blow the ocean onto us and freeze solid because of the salt content. That means that everyone here in Charleston is dead because none of these houses can exist below 20 degrees Fahrenheit.
I believe that.
All of our pipes would bust.
Oh, yeah.
All the mangrove trees would die.
Yeah, I'm fairly sure that area has not seen weather that cold since the last ice age 12,000 years ago.
It did snow one time.
It can snow at 32 degrees or right around there, but that's a far shot from zero.
Yeah.
Anyway, all right. I think we've done enough.
Merry Christmas, everybody.
Merry Christmas, everybody. Thanks for listening, and we're out of here.
Bye, Craig.